Welcome. Hi, this is Jim Moffitt, welcoming you to another edition of Zero Point Radio. I'm usually the co-host with Christopher Holmes on the program, but today we have a very special program, one which is unfortunately a very sad occasion, which has occurred because a week ago on Friday, Karen Hale, who has been Chris's partner and true love for more than a decade, passed away of a massive heart attack in Ottawa, just outside of Ottawa, Ontario. And so today's program will be in part a tribute to Karen, part in the sense that we'll be continuing tributes over the next several programs. And unfortunately, Christopher, who is with us in the background, has lost his voice, and so he isn't really able to communicate very effectively, but he will, I think, comment from time to time. Is that correct, Chris? Are you going to be able to say anything?
Yeah, I'll make an effort, Jim. Okay. Yeah, I try to rest my voice.
Okay. Okay, and also with us is Christopher's friend Kenny Jay, who's a musician, and I guess you guys got involved in some serious singing and playing music, and that was in part the reason for Chris's loss of his voice. And I noticed actually, Chris, at the funeral service on Friday, that your voice was going already a little bit, so probably singing was probably put you over the top in terms of your voice.
Yeah, Jim, along with too many cigarettes and Löwenbräu.
Well,
in a way, it was a relief to be through, and I had to be pretty focused for some days to help carry it all through.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, and then there's the whole stress level that you've been going through the last week and just on a variety of levels and very difficult time.
I would like to just bring in, this is Kenny G, let people hear his voice. Kenny J, sorry.
Kenny J.
Anyways, Jim, yeah, I'm present here with Chris, and he seems to be quite willing to participate in this in regards to how his voice is.
We had quite a night last night, Kenny. Hey, wasn't that some inspired music you were playing and we sang together on it?
Yeah, very inspirational, and I think we were just composing some music that was just the moment in time, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and so towards the end of the show, we're going to do Kenny's going to do a song, and we'll present this song we came up with. Working at the lyrics of it together, and so that'll be exciting at the end of the show.
Okay, I thought perhaps, Chris, then I would read your tribute as it appears, if that's okay.
I would really like that.
From your website, yeah.
Yeah.
Christopher's website is at www.zeropoint.ca. I'll try that again.
That's not me!
Well, somebody hasn't lost their voice, so the canine cohort is here, too. Again, that was www.zeropoint.ca, and on Chris's site, he has a tribute to Karen, and I'm just going to read from his tribute. For years, Christopher always referred to Karen as Special K. That was his nickname for her, but more recently, he's taken to calling her Truther Chick, and so this is from Tribute to a Truther Chick. On May 6, 2011, Christopher's love and companion, Karen T. Hale, died unexpectedly of a heart attack at home. Karen's body was cremated and her funeral service held on Friday, May 13th. Karen will be missed by her family and friends. Karen has been my love and friend for over the past 15 years and had become a dedicated truth researcher and activist since our rude awakening in August of 2006. On September 11, 2006, Karen and I were the only two truth activists on Canada's Parliament Hill, with posters to the effect that 9/11 was an inside job and distributing written materials which explained aspects of the fraud and public deception actually being perpetrated by our governments. I could never have imagined, as a person asleep, the extent of the crimes of our governments against us. Since awakening, Karen and I lived in the fire, exposing ourselves to risks, as I still do, trying to awaken an almost brain-dead public who share no uprightness of heart and moral outrage at what has been done to us as Canadians and world citizens. After the Dawson College shooting in Montreal, Karen and I traveled to Montreal to distribute a research paper I had written based on our observations of the fraudulent media coverage, trying to expose this incident as another false flag black operation. The Canadian shadow government wanted new laws to prohibit semi-automatic weapons, and this is another of their concocted shooting sprees, as they have committed around the world. Aren't they cunning and illuminated? Duh. Karen has supported me throughout my work and was the most able and apt truth researcher, always moving on to new discoveries and insights. A remarkable, sensitive, and talented woman, Karen felt morally outraged by what is being done by the psychopathic elites and Masonic goofballs and strove tirelessly to contribute to my work and together to the larger worldwide truth movement. 5 minutes before her death, Karen had insisted that I photo her with a T-shirt that she had made up, featuring a remarkable image by truther and inspired artist David Dees, depicting the royal wedding against the backdrop of human carnage and suffering created by such self-styled little elites. And if you look there at the top of the, if you're on the website, you'll see the pictures of Karen with the T-shirt on. What a pathetic joke. Karen was so caring for, referring to the elites, Karen was so caring for others, especially the disadvantaged, and had a hard time bearing the sadness and horror of it all. The following is a poem which Karen wrote, always wanting it to be illustrated as a children's book explaining certain principles of higher magic. This is a poem Karen wrote called "You Are a Star." You are a star, birthed from within, without the night. You are a star reflecting some light. You are a star. That's what you are. You are a star. You are a star that cries out, "I am," before flight. You are a star that's been pushed out into the light. You are a star. That's what you are. You are a star. You are a star filled with luminous light. You are a star blissful and bright. You are a star. That's what you are. You are a star. You are a star, a pearl of great price. You are a star, stuck in a jar. You are a star. That's what you are. You are a star. You are
Jim?
A star.
Jim?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Was that the end of the poem?
No.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Finish.
You are a star turned topsy-turvy from the flight. You are a star filled with limitless light. You are a star, that's what you are. You are a star. You are a star playing hide-and-seek in God's place. You are a star within a heart space. You are a star, that's what you are. You are a star. You are a star that heals with a smile. You are a star, that's what you are. You are a star. You are a star reflecting sunlight. You are a star no matter what you are. You are a star stuck in a jar. You are a star in a jar. And that's the end.
I'm just going to comment a couple things about the poem. You know, Aleister Crowley says the first principle of magic is every man and woman is a star. And the star represents, for Crowley, he talks about Hardit and Nui. And Hardit is the individual star element, and Nui is space. Nui means night in French. So we might imagine all different stars in the expanses of space. So in the magical nature, there's this conjunction of Hardit and Nui. So that's in part what Karen's poem about. And further, she adds a reference to the jar. And in part that comes from some poetry of the mystic Rumi, who says, quote, "Inside this jar are seven oceans and innumerable stars." And in mystical teachings, higher dimensional space is sevenfold. So a star stuck in the jar is like being stuck in space in a jar. So that's some of the associations and meaning of elements of Karen's poem.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim. So,
I like the image of the jars. In a sense, that's what we are. We're all containers of the vessels of light and at the light source within. And she talks about the heart space also. And a very nice poem. Oh, and you finished off here. Thank you, Karen, for your love and support, your courage and service to humankind against the insurmountable odds we face together. You are a star, an inspiration to me and loved ones to carry forward a cause of righteousness, truth, and love in a world gone mad. And so that's if people haven't been able to go and want to go to www.zeropoint.ca, you can see Christopher's tribute to Karen there and Karen's poem, and also a reference to an earlier web page that Karen had in 2007.
What place for reading that tribute, Jim?
I was just going to mention also too, Chris, about Don Nikoloff, that you had wanted just to make that mention that you had wanted to say thanks to Don Nikoloff from Evident Footprints on BBS, who had done a tribute to Karen on the event of her death, and you said also that you're going to be on his show on June the 2nd, the 16th, and the 30th of June to do a tribute series to Karen and to share some of her life and your experiences together.
Yeah, exactly. And it'll not only be about Karen, but just also I want to share like the revelations that occurred to me at a certain point and kind of talk a little bit about what people go through in the truth movement and that. You know, the other day I met a friend who's in Truth Action Ottawa, and he was telling me how the truthers in the group were kind of dissipating a bit because, in a way, trying to get the truth out there, it takes so much of a person's life and struggle and when they already have so many kind of life problems and issues. And at times it all seems so hopeless. And it's like everybody, no one listens in a way. Nothing happens, you know. The people call out for justice, and we live in this massive lie. The media just lies and deceives people every day. It's so pathetic. I just wonder, where is the conscience in human beings? How could our governments and media and everyone done such horrible things to us in modern times in our countries and created these wars around the world? It's just so, at times, overwhelming. It reminds me of what Gurdjieff says about bearing the sorrow of our endlessness. Mm. And that's kind of the quality Karen had in a way. She couldn't bear to see suffering and was so affected by it. And she herself, in a way, didn't fit in the world. In a way, it wasn't good enough for her. But she, to me, has been a hero in what she did. And I think of Karen and I say, tribute to a truth checker. Like, in my view, there's the unsung heroine of our age, not some Lady Gaga goofball who will do the most perverse and multi-dimensional sexual things that anyone would imagine. And she's some superstar. And it's also invented and insane. Not that I even know this woman's music, and I don't mean to be mean, but in a way, just the fraud of it all, the deception, the misguiding of people's attention and the spreading of such influences through our society. And as Karen and I, through the last years, we just became aware of so much, you know, how we're like just being sprayed all the time from the air, like the temple and the poison of the food and the water and all these GM foods coming in and more wars and our souls involved in wars based on public deception. And now we got a prime minister who wants to put $4 billion into prisons. I guess I'll have a handy spot in prison for him. I'm sick of this world. And I'd like now to Here's one of the songs Kenny and I worked out last night. Kenny came up with it, and we're working at the lyrics. So it's just, we'll just give a sample of it, and I hope to get into some music, and I don't know what we can do in this world. This is partly how I feel. This is Kenny G.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to try my hand at this composure that we were working on last night. And I hope that you enjoy it. It goes something like this. I'm sick of this world and how it is run. I'm sick of this world. It's begun. Look at the sky, and what do you see? Chemtrails are white. It's all you can see. Open your ears, world, if it's not too late. Listen up, world, we'll give it to you straight. I'm sick of this world. Sick of this world. In the air, it's poisoned every day. Look at these things we see in every way. Oh Lord, I'm sick of this world. Oh Lord, I'm sick of this world. Just a sample. There's another two verses that go with this, Jim. Okay. Anyways, I hope that you enjoyed that, and I'll be back a little bit later with a song that I wrote about 3 weeks ago. Anyways, I hope that you enjoyed that.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
Yeah. That's how I lost my voice last night. He started singing.
Started singing about how you're sick of the world?
Yeah, well, that and other things.
I
kind of showed him a little bit how if I ever got anyone ever invited me anywhere to speak and I wanted to hear what the kinds of things I have to say, how I might, my oratory capacity. And Kenny, it's been fun. It'd be fun to do some music. You know, it's like healing for the soul. I look forward to a bit of shift of energies and doing something along that line.
Yeah, music there's a great line about in the movie about the Last Waltz about the end of the band and Garth Hudson, who's organ player and sort of the music teacher of the group, talked about. He was talking at one point about the music on 52nd Street in New York, where the jazz clubs were in the 50s. And he said, you know, I think that's where a lot of the really wonderful healing took place. And I always loved that line about the healing and the healing capacity of music. You know, I think that's something that for myself, like I'm not much of a musician, but I do play the guitar a bit, and I find it very. At times, I find I almost need to play and to sing a little just to sort of get through my days. At times, I find it very healing and very centering in a way.
Yeah, great therapy, eh?
Yeah,
that's how I'm feeling a bit. I've always wanted to play music, but never really had the time. I'm going to try to work at the keyboard a bit, and we're going to try to get some jamming going here.
Yeah, good for
you.
We're
going to try to come up with some YouTube songs and just develop something musically about.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one thing that in terms of at the service that the minister, I take it that he was a minister, that the gentleman that spoke, I didn't actually get his name, but he asked us at one point to all sort of take a memory from Karen and to focus on that and to contemplate that and spend a few moments with that memory. And I, as I told you afterwards, my memory of Karen, I think my most enduring memory is maybe the first time I met her, which was, I'm not really sure of when that was. I think it was probably around 1997 or 98, around that time, perhaps. And it was when you had, you and Anita had your cafe in Kempville, and I had come up for, it might have been actually been the opening of your cafe, but it was around that time anyway. And you had told me about Karen, that you had met this really interesting woman, and that she was very interested in the work and in your work, and very interesting person. And I remember we were all seated upstairs in your cafe and just spent several hours talking. And I always remembered that conversation I had with Karen, because she had such interesting questions and such direct questions. It was like she had this sort of attitude that I think she really distilled things to their essence, and she didn't really care about all of the peripheral stuff. She wanted to know the essential questions and the essential answers. And I just always remembered that about her, that there was something really quite remarkable about her approach to things, that she just seemed to cut through so many things that were superfluous or perhaps like things that you and I would be engaged in, like more intellectual pursuits. She didn't really care about that. She just wanted to ask these other more basic questions, which she was very good at identifying, I think.
Yeah, it's very interesting you say that. That's what we originally met. She came out to my teaching at Zero Point Center, and she didn't mean to end up with the teacher. She came more out for the teaching.
Yeah, I like that when you said that, yeah.
In a way, it was sad in a way, because I had such a good relationship with Anita and been with her for 20 years. And in a way, there was a tragic element in our relationship from the first, in a way, in the terms of the hurt and that it caused in our families. But she was, in a way, an enrapturing woman. And I guess that's life, what happens along the way. I guess life is what happens while we're making other plans.
Yeah,
Lennon said that. Hey?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I used the word enchanting too, and I think Karen had that element too. She was. I was thinking. When I was driving home from the service yesterday, I was thinking about what lines in poems or song that I would think about, and one of the things about her, one of the things I thought was kind of from that Bob Dylan song, She Belongs to Me, where he's talking about a woman, but I think in a way he's talking about his muse, and he says, she wears an Egyptian ring that sparkles before she speaks. She wears an Egyptian ring that sparkles before she speaks. She's a hypnotist collector. You are a walking antique. And I sort of had that feeling at times about Karen, that she's sort of a, you know, I could see her with an Egyptian ring that sparkled before she spoke, you know. Sort of a magic.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. That's really
a magic priestess.
So on.
A magic priestess in a way, you know.
Hey, Jim, we're not really supposed to play commercial music on the station, but I'd like to play two songs that particularly meant something to Karen and I. And the first is from that kind of period of initial enchantment with her. And I'm going to just put it on the stereo here. I hope it comes across. I'll just take a moment here. And this is from Sarah Brightman's album, he called Eden, and this is the second song. Oh, actually, here, I mixed up here which song it is. Which one? I'll just bear with you a minute. I don't have this thing set up. Fill in there, Jim.
There's another song, Jim, can you hear me?
Yes, there is. Yeah, okay.
There's another, well, I can go ahead with this other song that that I wrote about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, how about that, Chris? Like, why don't we get Kenny to just come in?
Yeah, we'll fill Kenny fill in for a minute, and we'll try to deal with things here. Thanks.
Okay, go ahead, Kenny.
Yeah, okay, this is called Here I Am. It's kind of my very first kind of spiritual song, but it's got a nice ring to it, I think, and it meant a lot to Karen. The first time that I played it, it was in the kitchen, and she came down from the stairs, from upstairs, and she told me that she really, really liked it, so I'd like to contribute this song for Karen. Anyways, it's called Here I Am. Being so young, I didn't know much better. Living on my own, love, my life was so broken, lost and alone, tossing and turning, one Sunday morning, I couldn't sleep, a hunger deep inside of me, it was hurting. I couldn't eat. Found myself standing at a church just down the street, and people smiling and greeting me, and they were singing, "Here I am, here I am, oh Lord, here I am." To your promised land. A preacher stood up and put his hands up in the air and said these words to the people standing there. God will make a way where there's no way. He will give you words where there's no words to say. He will give you peace where there's no peace in your world. He will make the wrongs into rights in your life. And you'll be singing, "Here I am, here I am, oh Lord, here I am."
Very nice, Kenny J. Thanks for sharing that. It's a beautiful song.
Thanks, Kenny. That was great. I wish somebody'd play that in my kitchen.
Yeah, it's been fun having Kenny around.
Yeah,
I still got into playing and talking last night.
That's such
really a great time in a way.
That's just a beautiful, beautiful chorus, Kenny. Really, really, I really liked that a lot. It was very nice.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's just really, it's funny, like as soon as I heard it the first time, I kind of felt like I'd heard it before, which I think is sometimes the mark of a really wonderful song. And it's very nice.
Well, it's all original, that's for sure. And
good for you.
I just wrote it up, I guess you could call it atomic writing if you're familiar with that at all. But it just came flowing out of me, and it was after, a very touching experience, you know?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it just came out on the paper, and here I am.
Yeah, good. That's great. Christopher.
I'm not sure this is going to work, Jim, but I'll see here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of original material that I do. I've got about 29 songs to get out on the airwaves, and I like to do a lot of my own personal music, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've got some faster music and more kind of dancing music. I tend to lean a little more to the folk rock.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do a bit of rock and roll, too, but in the spiritual sense, I don't know how that would come across.
Yeah.
But all my music, I find, is moving to...
Okay, Kenny, I'm sorry. I think we got this going.
I think he's ready to rock here.
Yeah, this is from Sarah Brightman, Eden.
Thank you.
Oh, seems to be skipping at the end a little bit. I hope that didn't I'm not sure how that came across, Jim. Did you hear that okay?
No, it's kind of variable quality. Like you're getting getting sort of highs and lows, you know. So it's kind of hard to. It's a very beautiful tune. I know the tune actually, but it's like, it's kind of hard to hear it actually. I don't know if Kenny heard it.
I won't play another, or maybe I will try one other just to give a sense of it. But it's funny your comments about the Egyptian ring and such reminded me that music had that quality. The kind of mystery and depth of it. It's a very moving, soulful album. Yeah, Eden by Sarah Brightman. And I'd like to play one other thing, at least try to give a sense of it. Because during the first 10 years of our time together, probably our main band was Tea Party, which is a relatively unknown. Well, no, I mean, they became very famous, Tea Party, with their hit called Heaven Coming Down. But there was a certain kind of ecstasy to their music as well. And this song, it's called Psycho Pomp. And what it is about death. And you'll catch a line of fading away. And how things all, beautiful things and love, and how everything passes, everything fades away. And the kind of heroic and dimensions of life and what that entails. So I would like to try to play a bit of Psycho Pomp by Tea Party. And, one moment.
Thank you.
Yeah, how'd that come across, Jim? Probably not too muffled a bit and such.
It goes from a strange place, that music. It's very, I couldn't quite grasp exactly what they're saying, but it was interesting.
Yeah, you'd need to hear it clearly to be able to distinguish the lyrics and such a bit. I don't think I'll try to play another one from people I'd recommend. If you go to my website, I put up some of my musical favorites up there, and I'm going to work at my website over the next little while, continue some of my tribute to Karen, put some new music up, and I think it'll be a really interesting site. And it's not just a tribute to Karen, it's a tribute to truth checkers in general, in a way. I think we need new models of heroes and heroines in our age. It's like we've been so dummied down through the media and all the falsity of Hollywood and the deception of the public. It's like I'm so sick of this world, as Kenny would say sometimes. Any comments, Jim?
Well, I guess, switching perspective a little bit, the other side of things is that whenever someone dies and you're kind of left, you know, it stops you in your tracks, and you have to think about, well, what does all of this mean, and you know, what do we know, and you're kind of confronted with the mystery of it all as to what exactly happens. But coincidentally, recently I've been reading a lot about near death experiences and trying to put together this picture of what people say about the near death experience and how that correlates with what mystics have taught, and especially the commonalities in the visions of mystics and people who've had near death experiences are so striking that to me, I always sort of had an open mind about this. I mean, I think I certainly over the years I've become more and more convinced of the reality of all this, but I've never been so convinced as I am now that something does pass over from this dimension into another dimension and we have an experience. But I know that I went through a period where several people and an animal close to me all died within a very short period of time about 10 years ago, and I realized that what I came out of there believing is that, to me, the one thing that I really do believe, and this is just based on my own experience, I didn't read this or anything, but I feel this, as I think the only thing that really endures is that love endures. I think that there's something timeless about love, and I was reading about this person's very profound mystical experience that happened to this person who was an atheist, and he said that he experienced God, but not an anthropomorphic God, but that God, that he felt the love of God, but he said actually even that's kind of not right. It was more like God was love, and that's what he experienced, and he experienced the light that people talk about all the time, this brilliant light, and I think in a way that's it actually goes back to Karen's poem, is that, you know, we come in as a from a point source of light, and we descend into this world and we take on this body, and we are in this jar, and then I think we return to the light, and I think that there is a purpose to this life on Earth. I think that we are supposed to go here through things to learn and to try to evolve, and I think that. The part of us that really does endure, that really is somehow the higher part of us, is the love that we experience. And I think that the more we can experience that and experience it in an unconditional way, I think the more that part of us endures somehow afterwards. I mean, I don't really know what I'm talking about, but I have a sense of this that from these different accounts and from my own experiences.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I try to understand love through my life, to try to understand the different dimensions of it, and even what it is as a cosmic phenomena.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Einstein once said, someone asked him what held it all together, and he said love. And in a way, in mystical teachings, love is like gravity.
Yeah, exactly.
In Blavatsky's Metaphysics, like, in the beginning, like nothingness, and then you have a point source of light, and it expands within without, like the budding of a lotus, and the heart opens up and the self comes into the body, and so expands initially within without. And then as ultimately then the a living being dissolves, there's a counter movement from without within, returning to the source again at the end of time. And in Blavatsky's work, it is the Divine Mother, Nui, the eternal parent space, who at the end of time draws all the souls back to her bosom, because they emerge out of the heart of the Divine Mother, and at the end of time, all things are dissolved back into the heart of the Divine Mother. So, in that sense, gravity is a cosmic phenomena, and in a way, it applies to the soul, because the soul gravitates into its own realms. Just like material things fall to the ground, well, the soul breaks free of the material bondage, and it can return to its source, to its gravitational center at the heart of being. So human beings, we expand and contract through our own selves and hearts, as Blavatsky says.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's a very profound idea, and the more I read and think about this, the more it seems to me that that's exactly, you know, what does happen. And to a certain extent, I mean, I look at the world and all the horror and the circle of people turning in circles of what Gurdjieff called insignificant interests and insignificant aims, and just how, like, people do just unconscionable things to one another. But then I think of, like, you know, well, what is a life review going to be like for some of these people when they have to not only account for their own life but for the, you know, for the effects of what it's had on everybody else. Can you imagine some of these people? I mean, they're going straight to, I don't know what they're going to, but it's not going to be a good place. Part of me feels like, well, that's kind of like sort of pie in the sky, Bible thumping, in the sense that, you know, all, everything's going to work out, you know, Jesus is going to welcome us with open arms and everything. It almost sounds a bit naive, but I think understanding things, it is more like, I think I've come to the idea that there is some sort of karmic retribution, and that there is some sort of karmic justice, and that we are judged by our acts, and we all have to account for everything that we've done and everything that we thought and felt, and that, you know, that it's all significant, it all adds up, and then in the end, that I think there is an essential all rightness to the universe, and that's what people describe, and I think we are rewarded for our goodness and for our uprightness of heart, and I think that, you know, that's not the motivation per se, but I mean, it is important to be a good person, and it's important to realize that you're not going to get away with anything just because you think you're getting away with it on this realm. I think if some of these people actually knew what awaited them in the afterlife, they might develop a conscience or some sort of sense of morality, because maybe I'm grasping at straws here, because it's hard to kind of, you know, as you say, it's kind of hard to accept it all, that what's going on, but I do think that people, you know, will be held to account. Now, there is a day of judgment of sorts. It's interesting that Swedenborg, in his books, I was just reading a little bit about him and how he pretty much had all the same common elements that the near-death experience people had when he was in heaven, and he actually said that he witnessed people who had died coming into the afterlife and the opening of what he called the book of the book of life, where they had their life review people, you know, were confronted with the consequences of their actions and their thoughts and their deeds and you know, feelings. And I mean, that was, you know, 300 years ago, I guess, Swedenborg was talking about this, you know. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it's funny. I think these people will pass into, quote, a hell of their own design.
Yeah.
They're drawn into those realms that they fed, and like the lower levels of the astral plane, into hell-type conditions, according to their own natures. Like, these people don't realize, like, they think they're, what they're willing to do for, like, money, sex, and power in this life. And in a way, they don't, it's like they're soulless, or they don't believe in the life of the soul.
Yeah.
And they don't realize the consequences for them in afterlife states.
Yeah.
It's like in Beelzebub's tales, Gurdjieff, he has whole sections he talks about the fate of Hasnamuses in afterlife conditions.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that when we get back to the tales in a future date. And I believe it's like the law of karma. It's like sometimes I've heard it compared to like you take a young willow and you bend it over and over more and more and more. And then all of a sudden it snaps back. And it snaps back with a vengeance. And as the Lord says, vengeance is mine. It's like we don't see any justice on our earth. You know, our justice and our police systems have become so corrupted and complicit in these nightmare things. And in a way, it's like, vengeance is the Lord's. And in a way, it gives me faith and hope that in a way these people will face the consequences of their crimes against humanity, the things they've done to people over decades with all these wars and senseless pollution of the earth and the waters and everything, all the inventions they've suppressed. And it's just been terrible. They've kind of brought this social engineering in and taken people away so much from essence values, as Gurdjieff describes it.
Wow.
So they'll have their hell of their own design. And when they call out for mercy, I don't think I'm going to be around to hear. But I believe that. I believe fully in life after. And through Karen's death, in a way, what it does for me, it just inspires me more to kind of carry forward our work. Because I'd never really seen Karen so happy in her life and relationship as the last few months, and so determined and set on what we were doing. We had like so many different plans, like, what are we going to do to wake people up? Like, how come people can't see they're being poisoned in the air? You know, it's these terrible things. You know, and in a way, it was so much to bear upon her heart, you know, and We went through quite a struggle together, and I feel ready in a way to face going into the other side. If I pass away, I'll stay. I'll work on another plane, because I believe this is a multidimensional battle for the souls of human beings. They're workers and on different levels and dimensions, and I feel that Karen will be over there on the other side, and she's an inspiration to me. And I'd like to share with you, Jim, two amazing coincidences that happened to me last week around Karen's death. Many. One was when she wanted that last picture of her taken in that T-shirt, and she just happened to be standing in front of a picture on the wall of kind of a Christian saint, and so she had a halo around her head. That was one, because I didn't intend that. You know, that was just happened coincidentally in this random accidental universe. The second thing was, Karen had a pact somewhat with her niece, who she dearly loved, Chantel. And the pact was that whoever died first would try to communicate to the other. And I didn't know of this. And the first I spoke with Chantel, and I hadn't discussed Karen's passing with her, and she told me these two things, which were just like so unbelievably remarkable and appropriate. The first was, she said, she saw Karen there saying, What the fuck? What the fuck? I'm dead. How did that happen? What happened? That's me. I'm dead. It's like, because in a way there was no anticipation of it. We had so many plans and energetic and such a nice day, and she was so, feeling so empowered. And then all of a sudden your life passes, it's over. And that was like what her impression of what Karen, it was like so unbelievably appropriate to actually what occurred. And in a way, what occurred for me, too, is like, holy smokes, you know, there's my sweetheart and fellow tooth kicker, you know. And then all of a sudden, she's gone. And just so suddenly, and like, what the hell just happened? How did that happen? And it reminds me also of, like, Gurdjieff talks about how the only thing to save humankind is if they had an organ implanted in them, which had the effect of the Kundalini, to remove the effects of the Kundalini, oh no, like the Kundalini, that reminded them of the inevitability of death. And then we would value life and we would value love and relationships in a different way. But we fall asleep and get so caught up in insignificant interests and insignificant aims. And we don't realize what we're missing. And in a way, Karen lived her life in an epic dimension. Even though at times she had very difficult life and was a troubled soul by things and had broken hearts and had her heart broken, as happens to most of us. You know, like there's a tragic element to human life. And the second thing Chantal shared was she saw Karen there with her notebook and writing pad taking notes, because that's what Karen was. She, through the last year since when we woke up and learned the lie of 9/11, and then we just the last 6-7 years just studied, like, what's going on and what's all this entail and all these different things. And she was like a researcher. She'd like ferret things out, and she always kind of led me on, directing my attention or feeding me things to help me in our explorations together. So she was this little researcher. And you see on my page, you see her picture there above her poem where it says, "You are a star." And she has a star on her. And it's a Star of David. And my work deals a lot with the significance of the Star of David. Because in a way, the Star of David, if you put a seventh point in the center, that's the seventh mystery of the Star of David. You need a central point. Like the flag of Israel has no central point because they don't honor the divine in living beings. They're empty inside. It's like they're soulless creatures. Whereas to attain the seventh central point in the Star of David, that transforms it into this beautiful spiritual mystical symbol of the structure of human existence. The Star of David has an upward turned triangle representing fire and a downward triangle representing water. In fact, in the book of Genesis, in the beginning, the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. And if you took that line, the Spirit of God moving across the face of the water, you'd have the Star of David, the overlapping symbols for fire and water. And that's the Star of David. It's like a human being is a spiritual being and a material being. And the seventh point is the central core nucleus, the star element. And the Star of David also, it's like you have the threefold above and the threefold below. And in a human being, the heart is the seventh, is a central chakra. You have three below it. And most people's hearts are controlled by the three lower centers. But if you turn around in your heart and you become upright of heart, which is an ancient mystical teaching in Christianity, you become upright of heart, then your heart opens and you feel illumination and love and compassion and such. And that realization of self, the light of the self, can then illuminate the higher centers. So it's amazing how Karen had that star, and that's why in my dedication to her, I really feel through our struggles together and what I saw over the last years of the development and refinement of her soul, I undersaw her go through that alchemical process of transformation and attainment. So in a way, I felt she attained her star. She attained her eye. And she's still over there. I can see her on another plane. And that's okay. Maybe she'll continue her work there. Maybe she'll be reunited with her loved ones. Maybe she'll travel through the planes and have other life adventures over eons on time. Like, there are these mystical, multidimensional nature to what we are as human beings. And that knowledge has been so hidden and denied to humankind that we have no knowledge of the mysteries of the heart. I would encourage people, buy my book, The Heart Doctrine. Hey, Jim, it's like a profound book on what consciousness is and the kinds of things we're trying to share today.
Yeah, well, it certainly provides a very different way of considering the nature of consciousness and life, and I think a very profound overview and elaborates very distinctly in terms of both modern knowledge and ancient knowledge, a compelling kind of model as to what we are and really sets out something which is completely against the grain of all sort of contemporary thinking. I guess in reading, like recently I've been reading, like I reread Talbot's book, The Holographic Universe, and reading some other material. And I realize that more and more I see how everything in I would say, like, the whole premise of Western research into consciousness is, I just see how it's sort of this made-up story, which it superficially makes sense, and I think it's because the reason it superficially makes sense is because it's a partial truth. But I think there are, like, fundamental misconceptions about things, and that to me, just, you know, based on 35 years of study and conversation with you and my own experiences, and just this, like, this vast wealth of anomalous experiences and data, I just think that the whole head doctrine idea, this idea that somehow magically, and it is a very magical, if people realized how unscientific, in a sense, this idea that consciousness is generated by our brains was, if they realized how arbitrary that is, yeah. I think they would be quite astonished to understand that nobody really understands any of this. You know, this is all sort of being made up as people go along. And then you see how people are locked into this paradigm, which I think is a very valuable paradigm for studying aspects of consciousness. I think it's very, you know, like you say, it's a part, but I think it misses very essential things. And one of the things it misses is the critical things is the heart and how that's been elucidated in mystical and esoteric teachings over and over and over again, and how it provides a perspective which makes sense of so many things that are anomalous or enigmatic or seemingly impossible in terms of the conventional Western modern academic model of consciousness. And then also, like, how the striving for objectivity in the study of consciousness is completely misguided. Of that I have absolutely no doubt. You have to study consciousness in yourself, and you have to study it according to some sort of a system. And I just see how, like, that I would say that's a complete, that's a huge mistake of unfathomable proportions in modern consciousness research. And so all of these things are presented very well in the Heart Doctrine. And certainly, like, I think the astonishing thing is how the Heart Doctrine recurs in all of these different ancient esoteric and mystical teachings, and recurs in the same way with certain elements being repeated over and over again, as to the point where this can't be a coincidence that all of these people have come to the same knowledge. Like, it's based on something very profound, and as I say, I think it deepens if you're scientifically literate. I think it deepens your perspective immeasurably. Like, if you if you understand what science says about consciousness, and then you come to this, that then you have a much more integrated and I think a much more comprehensive and profound perspective. And for those reasons alone, it's just certainly worth reading the Heart Doctrine. Plus, it's very inspiring. It's very inspiring material. You know, it's just we have to realize, I think, one of the things, just to get back to something you were saying about Gurdjieff's point, if we could remember the inevitability of our death and of those of everyone around us, it would change everything. I mean, I've certainly tried to work with that prescription in my own life, and it has profound effects. And I think it shows that the distinction between knowledge and understanding things, between thinking about something and being consciously aware of it. Like, everybody knows that they're going to die. Everybody knows that. That's just, like, it's basic. We're taught that when we're young. We all know that, but nobody remembers that. And that's what Gurdjieff was talking about. He said if we could really be aware of that, that would, I mean, I can speak from experience on this. What it does is it leads you to disidentify with a lot of the things that you're invested in emotionally, and it leads you to be much more compassionate and open and humble with other people, because you realize that this is all transitory, that we're all impermanent, that we're all going to die, and that a lot of the things that we get caught up in and have these stronger emotional reactions to are absolutely ridiculous, because they're just like these ego conditioned reactions which really have nothing to do with anything real, and that's what is so liberating about this perspective. But it really underlines the importance of distinguishing between thinking about things, something and knowing it, and then actually being able to experience and remember it, which is really quite profound. It's a very good exercise to just try to remember that idea that you're going to die, and so is everybody around you. And the first thing you'll find is that you can't remember it. It's very hard to remember that. But if you work at it, you start to develop this very interesting, very subtle sense of joy it's the beginning, I think, of real conscience and higher emotional feelings, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
When someone dies and we go to a service for a loved one and we say, you know, that we're remembering their life and celebrating their life and mourning their passing, like, we're passing out of our usual emotional identifications, and I think we really have those moments where, you know, especially when we come together in ceremony, and I think that's the value of funeral services, memorial services, is that people do come together and there is a shared emotional presence, and I think people do remember it for a few moments anyways, that you know, hey, we're all going here. This is the omega point that we're all headed towards, and it's just a matter of time. And it reminds us of the preciousness of life and the tragedy of death and you know, how much it hurts and what a loss it is, but at the same time that you know, it provokes us to examine our lives and our purpose here, and I mean, it's very uplifting in a way. Like, death can be such a great teacher, but you know, it's a teaching in which we're all enrolled against our will, and I think most of us spend most of our time sort of turning our back on it instead of trying to remember it and trying to learn from it.
Yeah, just to pick up a couple points on what you said. As you say, like, I say that the Heart Doctrine is like this esoteric teaching in all the major religious traditions, and that's profoundly important. So it doesn't, you know, it's Lord Gita saying, I am the Self seated in the hearts of all beings, or it's Christ in the Sacred Heart of Christ, or it's the Kabbalistic, the Divine Spark descends into Tifereth. You know, we have all the Sufi mystics say the ultimate kind of mystery is this, the mysteries of the heart and this divine spark within a human being. So it is such a profound teaching. And people these days, we think of the Illuminati, and we think how illuminated they are, and their symbol of the pyramid with the eye in the top. Now, Blavatsky would call that the eye of dogma, like the eye of the mystically awakened, because you can awaken your higher mind or third eye, as people would call it. But she also says this. She says that the heart doctrine is really a deeper teaching than the doctrine of the eye. And I'd like to read a quote from Blavatsky. She says, "Learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom, the eye from the heart doctrine. But even ignorance is better than head learning with no soul wisdom to illuminate and guide it. The doctrine of the eye is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect. Great Sister is the name of the heart doctrine." It's like sifting for gold. Hey, Jim, you have that sand and you run water through a sieve and all the other things are washed out and kind of leaves those nuggets of gold. Yeah. It's a beautiful image of how to discern esoteric spiritual knowledge. In my books, it's like the awakening of the human heart. And I don't deny these goofball Illuminatis that they develop faculties and it within the astral realm, the astral light. But in a way, that's on lower levels and lower dimensions than the esoteric teachings of the heart. And there was one more thing. I told one story about Chantal and her coincidences, and I'll tell another story of what happened. The other day, I was working around the house, trying to get all the garbage out, clean up the house and get all the garbage out for garbage day. And I was working outside around the house, and I'm having people here as a reception tomorrow, and I just wanted to clean up and deal with things. And I was putting the garbage out, and a woman walking along the sidewalk, and she says, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear of your loss and your grief." And I said, "Oh, like, thank you." And she seemed very nice and sincere. And I said, "How did you know, or how did you hear of it?" And she said she had been walking along the street and saw my sign with my website on, zeropoint.ca. And she had Googled it on her cell phone and had read the tribute to Karen while she was outside the front of my house. And then she shared with me that she was a Buddhist monk, and she taught Buddhist meditation, and her specialty was communicating with the dead.
Oh, wow.
And I said, "Oh!" "Oh, that's kind of a remarkable coincidence with Dr. Sagan." Another random fortuitous event in the life of Karen Hale.
Wow.
Isn't that bizarre?
Yeah. So is she a Buddhist monk in your area?
Yeah, she lives close by, and I told her we're going to start doing things here out in the back on the lawn by the river and having music and try to put on some events. And I invited her, "Please come by and learn about what we're doing and contribute. And, you know, you lead us through a Buddhist meditation, you know, and because I want to give more public talks. I want to start, you know, I'm finishing up my final edits to the Slugs, and I want to finish up my Zero Point Teachings book, because that's autobiography in ways, and my political writings. So I want to finish those books, and then I want to start kind of have more of a public profile. So I hope that kind of develops. And like, I moved into Zero Point here a year and 4 months ago about, and I haven't done any public events or teaching because of my absorption and my writing and trying to get my works published. But, like, I hope I see another phase of movement. So, anyway, that was another remarkable coincidence. And we always find these remarkable coincidences around deaths, you know, where the grandfather clock stops or a book falls out Kenny mentioned to me he was thinking about Karen at night and just laying there, and all of a sudden a book fell out of the bookcase kind of thing. Just things like that. Those signs that, you know, there's so many of them. The people ordinarily, like, we just lack the kind of awareness, the sensitivity of the kind of meaningful connectedness of events in our lives. And realizing the multidimensional nature of life, you kind of open up to that magical realm in ways. And then those things occur more and more frequently. And in a way, you're leading a magical life. You know, and in a way, Karen had a magical life. And there were tragic elements to it. But she was also an inspired person who earned her star. So, yeah. So, you know, it's an inspiration for me to move ahead. And, yeah, it's been a wonderful show, Jim, today. I talked more than I thought I would.
Yeah, I was like, yeah. It's the zero-point teaching with Vito Corleone.
That's so funny.
But, yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's funny, too, because I mentioned to you that Karen was just a year older than my mother when my mother died, and you had said that, you know, you were talking about Karen, about that in a way that she just didn't fit in this world, and then you said that her service, that, you know, in some ways she was too good for this world, and I remember when my mother died that you said to me that you thought that she was kind of an advanced person. And this is long before, I think, you know, you had any interest really in any kind of esoteric or spiritual teaching, but you just felt that she was sort of a person who'd done her work, and that, you know, that's why she sort of went early. And I mean, it's funny because in a way, like, I see that, like, you know, similarity is that with my own mother, like, you know, that she certainly seemed tragic and awful that she should die at such an early age, but in a way, like, it I can see it in the sense that you know, she did.
Yeah, she was ready to move on. She
It's like she'd sort of done what she was here to do. You know, I mean, in a way, like, it sounds very callous, but I don't mean it in that way. I mean, obviously, I wish my mother was still alive. You know, and I mean, and I always feel kind of really horrible that she missed out on so much in terms of her grandchildren, and just, like, to see what happened to her own children, to, you know, be with my father and everything. But also, I always had that sense of my mother, is that she, compared to anybody I'd ever met, she seemed more advanced, you know. She just seemed to be, she seemed to be, like, a more enlightened person than anybody else that I knew. And I'm not just saying that because she was my mother. I just never really met anybody like her, you know. She was really quite an extraordinary person.
Yeah, her intelligence and sensitivity, you know.
Yeah.
And having essence values.
Yeah.
Like Jeff talked about having essence values. And I see so much our society has been engineered to destroy essence values in people. You know, it's more and more titillation and perversion and breakdown of the family and religion and morality and such. It's like people have lost their essence values.
Yeah, well, I just think the whole thrust of modern life is towards, is Gurdjieff says it in Search of the Miraculous, you know, and that was 100 years ago when he said it, but the whole sort of thrust of modern Western society, the good side of it was that there was this amazing scientific and technological progress, and that was very valuable, but it was like that the line of knowledge outstripped the line of being, and that contemporary culture required automatons, and it was becoming more and more the case. And I mean, I would say, like, 100 years later, it's like it's even more so that you know, that people are more mechanized and they're
it's like the land of the walking dead.
Well, yeah, it's kind of
say, people look up in the sky, it's airplanes, they're spraying you. Don't you see that? Can't you see it? It's like no one can see it, and too busy, and what can you do? And I told a person yesterday outside the bank, and she said, oh, I thought it was for mosquitoes.
Well,
like, it's like, hello, reality calling.
Yeah.
You're the mosquitoes.
There's a level of profound denial and stupidity about
I
so
know.
Many.
About it's so many, sad.
About so many things.
Yeah, there is. Eh?
Well, it's really tragic,
it's
too.
Tragic.
When you read the tragedy
in the life of humanity.
You
take someone like Karen. She had like 55 years and, in a way, had such a enraptured life. And I think, you know, in a way, the tragedy of her death is nothing compared to these people whose lands are desecrated and they're bombed and they're deformed and their families are destroyed. All these horrendous things. It's just so unspeakable and so unnecessary. It's like mankind never made it out of the age of the caveman. You know, not to be insulting to cavemen.
Well, it's like, you know, if you look at the figures in terms of what various groups estimate in terms of what it would really take to feed and to provide everybody on the planet with clean water, and it's like a fraction of the military budgets of like the largest nations, you know, and you realize like how everything's geared to make all this money to spend on weapons and to enrich certain people when, you know, really you could spread so much goodwill with such a small fraction of that money. And it's like sort of people are blind and, you know, they hate the other and they fear the other. And, you know, there's always somebody.
Exactly. That's
always,
what Jeff Fate talks about as the causes of war.
It's
like
just
how
so
everybody
ridiculous.
Really hates each other and fears the other. You know, they don't open their hearts in love and feel parts of the other. Why do we have to have an elite in this world who are so psychopathically, mentally disturbed that none of them want, doesn't anyone among the elites want to serve humankind? They want to kind of amass this wealth while they're happy to starve people and impoverish people. It's like Uncle Scrooge. You know, they sit on this wealth and amass it all, and then they speak only lies, you know? Like the church, Roman Catholic Church, the wealth of the church. Why don't they ever feed anybody? You know, or help with these problems of humanity, or these kings and queens and royalty. They don't have royalty of blood. You know, we have inbred psychopaths and perverts and pedophiles and parasites. It's terrible. Where are those noble of heart among our leaders? It's so sad in a way, because so many of the problems of humankind never had to be. You know, they're created by ourselves out of the falsity of our egos and the psychopathy of the human psyche. You know, and it was all unnecessary. And you look at human history, hundreds of millions murdered and died in wars and poisonings and all these things. And I really feel we're at a critical stage and period in the history of humankind, because there's a growing worldwide growing awareness of this. We as humanity, we have to try to come together to help these elites turn around. Because in ways, I feel sorry for them. Because in ways, they're victims of circumstance and their education and traumas too. Like, when I worked with criminal offenders, I could never not understand why offenders did what they did when I heard their story and understood how they became what they became. And I think the elites were like that too. You know, I don't think originally like they, in a way, they thought they had noble kind of goals. You know, they're going to save humanity by reducing the population. Isn't that noble of them? They just got a mass murder for 1 billion people, and then they'll be happy. Everybody in prison and chips and, you know, and so it's so amazing. And I think the only way of looking at it is it's God's story. And compared with God's story, nothing any human being's ever written has anything paled in comparison to what's occurring and has occurred through humanity in the life of mankind. And it's a cool story. So anyway, Jim, I'm coming to the end of being talked out. I really appreciate your being there at the funeral and helping and carrying today. And I'd like to just remind listeners that Jim and I are going to kind of carry this on, and I'm going to tell some of my autobiography and my and involved and relationship with Karen over the next three episodes. And it's not just about our lives, but it's about like the problems of humanity and the issues we're facing in our times. And I appreciate your being there. It'll give me time to kind of reflect on it all and try to come to where I'm at in my life and see how to move forward. And so we'll have our next three shows, and then after that, we'll get back to Beelzebub's Tales, Jim. I got a new edition coming out within 2 weeks, I hope. I'm almost there. And also, I'll re-mention the three shows on Evident Footprints with Don Nikoloff. And thank you, Don, out there. I love you, Don, and I often listen to your show. Karen and I always used to listen to Don's show when we could, because we felt he had the same kind of sense of moral outrage we have about what we see being done. So, Jim, I'm going to sign off in a moment. Kenny, I'm going to get him to play that song, that new song we've come up, and it's just a prelude to what we hope to develop over the next period. And at some point, we'll get his music up on MP3 so we can play it out properly. And we may come out with a CD on this show and some of the music and promote the You Are a Car, You Are a Star, You Are a Star concept. So thanks for doing the show, Jim. I'm going to sign off. Kenny's going to play a song, and then maybe you can close down.
Okay.
Thanks. I love you, Jim.
Okay.
Thanks for your work with me for 40 years, Jim.
Yeah, take care.
Okay.
Look at our world and how it is run. I'm sick of this world. The movement's begun.
The movement's begun.
Look at the sky.
Look at the sky.
What do you see?
What do you see?
Chemtrails of white.
Chemtrails are everywhere.
It's all you can see. Open your ears, Will, if it's not too late. Listen up, world, I'll give it to you straight. Oh, I'm sick of this world. Look at this world.
Thanks, Kenny.
You're most welcome.
I guess we'll have you again in coming shows, so I look forward to that.
Wonderful. I'll work on some new material for you.
Great. Thank you, Kenny.
You're welcome.
And Chris, are you still there? I think Christopher's gone, too. So I'll just I'm just going to close. There's a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, which Chris read at the at Karen's memorial service, which I think is really appropriate, and I think is something that to take comfort in, but also something that's very provocative. And if you're not a believer, if you're an atheist or an agnostic, but is just something to think about. And it's Lord Krishna is instructing Arjuna on the battlefield, and he says that while speaking learned words, you, meaning Arjuna, are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither the living nor the dead. And he goes on and he says, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. And so he's basically just describing the imperishable principle that arises as the human soul and then passes into this other dimension and continues to exist. In remembering Karen, I think that it's something to consider and to meditate on in terms of each of our own existences, in terms of the impermanence of it all, and that we're all going to at some point pass into something else. And of course, none of us really knows what that is. But I've always loved that verse from the Bhagavad Gita, and I was really pleased that Chris read it at Karen's funeral. So we're gonna sign off a little early this week under the circumstances in terms of Karen's death and the loss of Chris's voice. But we will be back, and as Christopher said, in subsequent programs, we're going to Christopher be giving a presentation regarding Karen and his work with Karen over the past decade, it's about Karen, but Karen would like this, I think. It's about Karen, but it's about a lot more than Karen, and I think that's the real value of it, and I think that's the real value of what Karen was trying to do. And as Chris said, it's time for him to reflect on what he's going to do in the future, and to try to figure out what his work is in the time that he's got a life left to lead on this plane. So. We'll look forward to that. We'll also be returning to our discussion of Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. Chris mentioned that he's written another, I think he said 65 or 70 pages, and we were discussing this yesterday when I was at the funeral service, and I pointed out to him that now his book, The Slugs, it was already very substantial, but he has so much material that it's really quite unique. There aren't very, oddly enough, there aren't very many many books, period, about Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. There are a few, but it's surprising how little substantive literature actually exists in terms of discussing it. And I think Christopher's perspective on the book, given his study of the Fourth Way and the fact that he's a psychologist and that he's studied numerous other esoteric teachings, is very, very interesting. I think his work is really a major contribution to the study of a work which really should be studied much more closely and much more extensively. So we will be coming back and discussing more about Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. And I hope in future programs that we can touch, get in more detail discussion of what I touched on today in terms of these commonalities in the description of the near-death experience and the mystical teachings throughout the ages about these extra earthly dimensions, these higher dimensions, whatever they might be. I'm not really sure even how to describe them, but these dimensions, these planes of existence in which people encounter these beings of light and talk about this, and because this is a pervasive element in the descriptions of the mystical transcendent experiences and the
the near-death experiences that, that so-called ordinary people have today who are revived as a result of cardiac resuscitation methods. And I think it's really fascinating to discuss this, and it fits in very nicely with the other elements of the model of consciousness that, that Christopher and I are presenting on these programs and that, that he's developed over several years. So we will be back in 2 weeks, and we look forward to joining you again, and as I say, taking up the further discussion of Karen Hale's life and her work with Chris. And again, Christopher's website is www.zeropoint.ca. You might want to go on there and take a look to take a look at his writings. I would highly recommend The Heart Doctrine and his other works, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, is also out, and they're both available through Amazon. And so check that out if you have an interest. Okay, James Moffitt signing off, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks very much.